You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Public schools have been the center of heated public debate in recent years. There's been a backlash against school COVID policies, arguments in the political world and in school board meetings about how schools handle issues of race and gender, and concerns about post-COVID declines in some nationwide testing scores. It can be easy to feel pessimistic about education, but our next guest sees something else, opportunity. They say it's a good time for school leaders and other stakeholders to embrace fundamental changes, connect with their communities, and turn to local democracy to solve these problems. And in their new book, they have lots of examples to share. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent or community member, have you had an opportunity to work with your school district? Was there a good line of communication? If you work in schools, are you looking for ways to connect with your local community? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Landon Mascareñas and Donnie Tran are longtime educators, founders of the Open System Institute, and their new book is called The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. Donnie, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
And Landon, thanks for being with us.
Wonderful to hear you and be with you.
Landon, start us off with a big picture. What do the two of you mean by an open system as it applies to schools?
Well, first off, thanks for having us. And fundamentally, the big idea is that for too long in our nation's education systems, and actually in public systems generally, they have been closed off from the communities they serve, which means they have not been designed by the communities that surround them, whether that's because they were built in the past or because the population or community has shifted over time. We need to build more adaptive, interactive, and public systems, including our education system, that take in the information, work with stakeholders, family, parents, community members, business, to reimagine what's possible, and through that, become open to co-creation and co-design with their community.
Donnie, the two of you have worked with districts around the country, particularly Colorado, but elsewhere as well. How does this start? If a school leader is hearing this and saying, okay, this sounds good, sure, of course I want to engage with my community, where do they start?
Well, we think about trying to identify what we call an open moment, an opportunity to do the kinds of co-creation that Landon was just talking about with the community. And so the first step is really trying to identify what is that thing that both the leaders within the system and, you know, organizations like the board and the public, where can we agree that co-creation can be used to the highest and best effect? And so the thing that we recommend first is find that and then really assemble an unusually diverse and inclusive group of community members and frontline educators and young people to really train their attention and energy to that problem.
Landon, I can imagine somebody on a school board or say an administrator saying, well, hey, I try to have a public meeting on blank, or we invite people to the school board meetings, but nobody shows up unless there's something really controversial. Then everybody shows up and yells at us. What's the starting point for having bringing people on board, as Donnie was just saying, and having productive, collaborative meetings?
Well, you know, you brought this up earlier in the introduction, but, you know, our public education system, like so much else in our democracy, is really undergoing a stress test to see if it can actually respond to the increased demands of the communities and parents and families they're a part of. But we really believe it's muscle building. It's about finding that moment and then actually building up on top of it, whether that's in a rural community in Colorado, thinking about how to build an economic development strategy, or in Kentucky to think about the way learning and assessment gets reimagined, or school discipline questions. These are political decisions that create opportunities for consensus building and working together. We have to admit that the way that too often this happens in both our public setting, but in education, are broken. The way we do task forces and committees aren't effective. And a big part of the book is building a shared discipline and recommendations on how to do that effectively so that progress can occur.
Donnie, how can a school reach out to a community that hasn't been at the table as much, whether that's maybe a new immigrant community or a religious minority that feels excluded? How do you start to build those bridges?
Yeah, well, what we have found is that really intentional outreach with a very clear ask and a defined timeline helps people see their own role in the work and to understand that it's not an open-ended commitment that's going to last forever. They understand the thing they're going to do in service of the system. So I'd say that first of all. And then really making thoughtful and culturally appropriate outreach, both through translated materials, is a critically important thing to do. And then also there are always folks in the community who are trusted brokers and trusted intermediaries between the system and different communities. And so conceptualizing, we are all in this together, and really identifying those folks who can build those bridges and making sure that they understand the task at hand and understand that you are coming into this with a true co-creation ethos in place really can help engender the kind of trust that allows these relationships to be built.
Talking to Donnie Tran and Landon Mascarenhas, we're talking about their new book, The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about what you're hearing? Is your experience with the school district, whether you're a parent, a student, or you work with the schools, does it sound like what they're talking about? Or does it sound like there's a barrier between the people running the schools and the rest of the community? Have you found ways to bridge that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm hoping each of you can give us one example of this kind of work in action. You've mentioned doing work in rural and urban communities. Landon, let's start with you. Give us a little bit of a case study that illustrates some of the points you've been making.
Well, one of the book is organized into a set of six principles that are each organized, again, around a case study or a vignette. And the first chapter is about open leadership, which is the idea that leaders in our education system have to act as democratic leaders. I mean, too often in our education management text, our training, we teach education leaders and a lot of public system leaders to be top-down folks that say, this is my way, and I have to rally people to this vision I have. And instead, we bring a lot of other types of ideas into that. And the case study that we showcase is a project I got to work on with a lot of really incredible people around Colorado called the Homegrown Talent Initiative, which had eight communities that said, we want to think differently about bringing business, community partners, students, and parents and families and higher ed to the table to imagine a vision for rural economic development in our community. And through that, built internships and projects and new relationships with business that actually in many of these rural communities had atrophied and they had felt very isolated from each other. And in many of these places, there was a new spirit of kind of democratic connection and possibility. And we believe that's a critical aspect to what makes this work happen.
And Donnie, another case study in the book is in Denver as an example of what an urban environment might do with an open system. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. A really powerful story there. I see it from the perspective of the school leader that we got to know, who said to us, like, this is not really my school and this is not my vision. This is the community's school and the community's vision. It's just my job to execute on that. And so he built, it was part of an initiative called the Year Zero Turnaround Project, where instead of, you know, the traditional turnaround models that are used, he spent an entire year really engaging with the community, building trust, building shared vision, and then executing on it. And what he found was that he actually unlocked a lot of capacity and energy from engaging the community in this way. I mean, sometimes we joke that surveys and focus groups are sort of unequal to the task of deep buy-in creation and the kind of buy-in that co-creation can really engender. And so what we saw in Drew's case study in Valverde Elementary was that really co-creating with this community brought families and their energy and their expertise with their young people into the school space.
We're talking to Donnie Tran and Landon Mascarenhas about their new book. It's called The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. They say schools can find success by reaching out to their local communities, bringing the public on board as much as possible. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see opportunities for your local school district to connect with the community, do some of the things our guests are talking about? Is there an issue in your local school that you think has been handled well or poorly? Do you feel like there's good communication between the community and the school district, or bad communication? Do you have a question for our guests about how all of this could work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Landon Mascarenhas and Donnie Tran about their new book. It's called The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. They're making the case that school leaders should reach out to their local communities and harness the power of local democracy to create a better education system. Still time for you to join in if you have experience trying to solve a problem with a school, whether that's as a parent or community member or a teacher or administrator. Love to hear how things worked and didn't work in that situation and your questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Landon, one key idea I think underlying a lot of this is the solution for school A that a community comes up with might be very different from the solutions that community B comes up with, and that's okay.
That's totally right, Rob. You know, actually, a big part of the challenge that we've seen in a variety of education initiatives that have come across this country and around the world have really struggled with this idea of we have to replicate and scale and replicate and scale and this compulsion for copy paste. But the reality is that the solutions have to be tailored in a hyper local way. That homegrown talent initiative I talked about earlier, 8 communities all over rural Colorado. Each community came up with their own vision of what a graduate should actually achieve. Different words, different visions, different possibilities, different types of the way they wanted to make it manifest. And those hyper-local solutions have to be co-created at the local level, not only to create legitimacy and buy-in, but to actually tailor them to the unique features of that community.
Donnie, I could see somebody at a school district saying, yeah, that sounds great, but the state is going to test all my kids X number of times a year. We have to meet their standards, and there might be federal standards we have to meet. And if the solution our community comes up with, you know, works on some standards but doesn't help, you know, with those test scores, well, we kind of lose in some ways. Is that a problem?
Yeah, I think we need to embrace some both and thinking on this, that what we are talking about is really unlocking the capacity of parents to be partners in school and to be partners in their young people's success. And there's going to always be times when the things that they want are going to be a little bit orthogonal or a little tangential to what the ways in which schools are assessed. But oftentimes parents and schools like deeply want the same thing. When they get on the same page about it, it's a powerful lever for really improving the kinds of outcomes that we want for all of our children. And those, and also at the same time they're doing that, they can dive more deeply into the things that make their communities unique and use those as lenses to really engage with all academic content. So we see it as a both and.
Landon, one concern that nags at me is, you know, parents have kids, they often have jobs, their schedules are busy. How could people try to convene these kind of open system schools make sure they include people who don't have a lot of time necessarily to participate?
It's a really good question. I mean, fundamentally, this is a big dilemma in the family engagement community partnership space, is how do you create conditions for spaces to be created where there's equitable access for all individuals? When I was at Denver Public Schools helping to run the family engagement office, this was a major concern of us. You know, we had to provide translation and schedule things at appropriate times. You know, I never would have said it before the pandemic, but I've come to believe that virtual meetings are a major part of the solution. They create enormous amounts more access, especially across geographical areas. You can call different types of conversations into existence. Parents don't have to find childcare for their kids. They can Zoom in. It also reduces some of the affinity barriers that we see show up when we create spaces like this, where everyone who knows together hangs out together and has the pre-meeting and the side meeting. And so I think that there are some really interesting solutions that the pandemic has offered to us in these moments. And one of the things that we talk a lot about in the book, Rob, is that we have to disrupt the traditional way that we think about building these spaces. It can't just be one place on a website to have an application to get on, and only the people that have time and energy to get on make it. The school districts have to think about random selection, inviting new people into the process, bringing social capital leaders in the community through direct invitation. That's a part of the design as well, is that we have to think bigger and broadly about the way we practice inclusive democracy.
Donnie, I want to get something back to something Landon mentioned earlier about kind of changing the idea of what it means to be a leader at schools in the first place, from the idea of I have this vision that I'm going to implement and I'm going to try to get buy-in for it, hopefully, but I'm going to do things my way, to becoming a leader in the sense of let's find out what people want to be led to in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. That was very well said. That what we see is many people who are in education shy away and say things like, oh, I don't like the politics. I don't like doing politics. And I think that really is a narrow view of what we even mean by that word and what we mean by the act of public leadership. And we really do think that principals and superintendents and state commissioners are all public leaders. And we think of this act of leadership within an open frame is, how do I deeply understand and empathize what we collectively want and need to feel whole and successful? And then how do we bring our collective energy to bear to make that a reality? And it doesn't mean that a leader comes in with no opinion and does whatever the community wants. It means that they create a space for deliberation, dialogue, and different kinds of expertise to come together and truly form something that is shared between all of its participants.
Talking to Donnie Tran and Landon Mascarenhas about their new book, The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. Landon, obviously the target audience, I think, for your book is for people who are in those school leadership positions or work in schools. But how about if there's somebody out there listening, maybe a parent or concerned member of their community saying, this sounds great, I would love to see more of this in my district. What can everyday people do to try to work with their schools to at least experiment with these open system concepts?
You know, Rob, when we were writing the book, we were really intentional to say that there's two audiences for the book. There is the education leaders that we're talking about right now, the principals, the superintendents, the commissioners, the teachers. But we really intentionally also design it for folks outside of the system, the community organizer, the parent, the activist. And we really said that part of the dilemma is that these two groups of people, in fact, across all of those different stakeholder groups, don't have a shared language. And that a big part of our idea was to create a shared discipline so that when they are working together, when their values are actually aligned and they're trying to do this work and they want to get started, they can start having big moves together or small moves together that they can use together, use a similar language. And it's a part of the reason we use the term open. It's not a complicated word in the discourse. You know, when we would line up a bunch of educators or parents and say, what does family engagement mean to you? You get a, you know, 100 different answers. When we talk about openness, it conjures up something deep inside of us. We understand that at a more fundamental level. And I think when we've worked with parents and educators in conversations like this, they can start to identify simple, clear moves, whether it's the way that home visits can occur, the way an after-school program can be available, the way that a diploma can be more accessible and online, that both parties can come to the same space around.
And one big point there, Donnie, that Landon reminds me of is you're not making the case that an administrator should completely overhaul their school district between now and opening day at the end of summer. People could start small. What can you give some more examples of the kind of small projects that people could work to implement these open system ideas on?
Yeah, absolutely. We never try to fool people into thinking that open system work is easy. First of all, it is powerful and deeply fulfilling, but it is a challenge to be the container and the heart and one who harnesses and cultivates all of this energy. And so we do recommend that people look very carefully at the system that they're in and ask themselves, like, what is the thing that is the right bite size at this moment? And given my capacity and the energy and trust within my community. And so it can be anything from, you know, as Landon mentioned before, school discipline policies, or something as ambitious as grading policy. Okay, that's not a beginner move. I just want to be clear about that. But it could be also something small in terms of, well, how might I co-create, you know, a family night or a, you know, the process for, you know, doing something operational at the school so that it feels like there you can build a little bit of muscle around how to engage your community in a deep way.
Landon, in just our half minute, the last half minute or so, you've been making the case for the open system for a while. Are people buying what you're selling? Are these ideas catching on?
You know, one of the reasons we're really excited about this book coming out, Rob, is that we have stories from all over the country. Georgia, Kentucky, Chicago, Colorado, New Mexico. There is a hunger in our country right now, we believe, coming out of COVID because of the democratic stress test we're under. There is a hunger and a desire for more involvement in our schools. And the answer can't just be, it's too much. We have to say, if public education is the forge of our democracy, we have to open up to let people in. And we have been inspired by people from around the country taking on that charge. Because they believe deeply in the future of what education is possible when we all work together.
Thanks to both of our guests today. We've been talking to Landon Mascareñas and Donnie Tran. Their new book is called The Open System, Redesigning Education and Reigniting Democracy. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, rags to riches, the self-made man. They're common phrases in American history. They're usually used in a positive way, virtues that help us find success. But our next guest says too much self-reliance has its downsides and that these ideas are at a toxic level in American society. In her new book, she makes the case that they limit our economy, our politics, our day-to-day lives. She calls for a more helpful future where we can be comfortable depending more on one another and, in some cases, the government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the principle of self-reliance has gone too far, or do you like that this is a big part of the American ideal? If you have lived in the U.S. and elsewhere, how do you compare and contrast our ideas of self-reliance in the United States versus other places you might have lived? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Alyssa Quart is a journalist, poet, and author of books including Squeezed and Republic of Outsiders. She's executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. She collaborated with WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge on a three-part series called Going for Broke. Her latest book is called Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. Alyssa, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, it's great to be here.
You've written a lot in the past about money, work, and how tough it can be to afford life in the U.S. for a variety of reasons. What led you now to tackle the idea of self-reliance?
Well, I've been running this organization, the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, which I created with the late, great Barbara Ehrenreich, for 10 years, which means I've gotten 10 years worth of letters and comments from people saying, you know, why are the people that you write about and the people who write for us, because some of our writers are working poor, why are they struggling so much? Why don't they own their house? Why do they own their house? Why don't they have a college education? Why do they have a college education? Kind of fault finding people for their own economic instability and poverty. You know, why do they have kids out of wedlock or, you know, without a husband? You know, why do they have kids with different men? You know, and there's a lot of blame and kind of moral finger pointing that I saw. And I wanted to know where that all came from.
You dug into this history. And one of the things you found is this idea of pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps that made it into the title of your book was actually originally kind of an absurd statement, a mocking statement. Some of the first examples is, interestingly, in newspapers here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about the origin of that phrase?
Yeah, there was a farmer named Nimrod Murphy who, and they were sort of this newspaper article was mocking him for that he wasn't going to be able to get over the Cumberland River or a barnyard fence, and they used the straps of his boot as a joke. And then later in the Racine Advocate, they said, you know, the governor must be trying to pull himself up by his bootstraps. And again, it was mocking somebody like, what a joke, like you can't chew gum and walk at the same time or whatever. It was that kind of phrase. But over the decades, it became this reality. People were like, okay, I gotta really do this. You know, people are taught in school now that they're supposed to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Somebody came up to me at an event and told me that he'd been taught that in school. So we've come a long way since it was a joke in Racine.
Then there's the frontier idea where, you know, people went out and homesteaded and settled and lived tough lives, which they did. The tough life part is pretty true, I think. But as you point out, they did it in one of the largest federal government giveaway programs ever. Can you talk about that that paradox of our frontier myth-making?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, what inspired this was I was reading Laura Ingalls Wilder, Little House on the Prairie, and, you know, Plum Creek, and all these other, which of course, you know, she was actually born in rural Wisconsin, so it's perfect. I'm talking to you about this in 1867, but her books were all extolling, you know, her Ma and Pa. We remember them, you know, Michael Landon in the 1980s TV show, 70s and 80s, doing it all by themselves, you know, planting their crops. As it turned out, when you look into this, first of all, Pa was a terrible farmer and he needed the help of his neighbors to, you know, feed his family. But second of all, they got money from the federal government through the Homestead Act of 1862. So this family got a parcel of land for free, and it was one of the biggest land giveaways in our country's history. And one of the pioneer mythologies, right, is we did it on our own. We arrived by this in this covered wagon. We chopped our own wood. We built our own house. That, sure, that's true, but they also got the land for free. This is not happening now.
I'm going to skip over a bunch of history and look at the present day and the stories we tell about ourselves. And you say whether we're talking about politicians or a lot of people who might look self-made on the face of it, parts of the story, parts of the biography get left out. Could you talk about our, I guess, modern day myth making?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's somebody right now who's about to be indicted, Donald Trump, who would constantly say he was a self-made man and that his father was a Horatio Alger story. But it, obviously, I mean, he was raised with millions of dollars. He'd been given $1 million loan, right, to start a business. And, you know, he was in a huge amount of debt also, and he kept borrowing money. So he was dependent on his creditors as well. And obviously, every single person who worked for the Trump organization, and at this point, these, you know, millions of voters who follow him, and Elon Musk similarly is sort of extols doing things by himself. You know, now he owns our big social media platform, Twitter. But you know, he also got money for his research and development from the federal government, and he also came from wealth. And so I just felt it was important to keep saying, not that there's something shameful about coming from wealth, but these people were born on second or third base. And so this assumption that we're all supposed to be able to be a tycoon or a titan or run for president or, you know, just survive easily is a lie.
Talking to Alyssa Court about her new book, Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. You can join in with your thoughts, experiences, or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Paul is with us in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hey, how you doing, Rob? Good to hear you.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Paul?
So in my early 20s, I was a floundering, panicky, angsty young man trying to sell stereos and TVs in a store and just trying to make my way. And you know, in our system, afraid of sort of just poverty, I guess. And I moved to Denmark, and I lived there for 16 years. And in my time there, the first thing they did when I landed was gave me a national health card. So I had free health care. And then I received a stipend until I got on my feet, which took me about a good 6 months to start being self-sufficient. And they would even supplement via aid if I needed it. My kid right now is going to college. It's paid for. Taxes are enormously high there, in our view. So if you're rich in America and you look at their tax base, you would say, this is crazy. However, when you think about how it's distributed, they don't have the angsty, panicky young people like I was. I'm extremely grateful for a social democracy, not a socialism, but social democracy.
Paul, thanks for sharing your experience. Alyssa, what do you think of his compare and contrast story there?
I love that. I mean, one thing that I found, I looked at volunteerism, you know, where people lend a helping hand, right? That's something that is always being extolled in this country and is supposed to replace the kind of social safety net the caller just mentioned. But in countries with the highest volunteerism rates, Denmark, as he said, Netherlands, Canada, New Zealand, they also have the strongest government-supported safety net. It's not a zero-sum game. You'll still be helping your fellow man, and you'll still be, you know, creating mutual care systems in your social environment if you had a better social safety net. And also, I mean, if you look at the OECD numbers of industrialized nations, the U.S. has one of the gives the least part of their GDP to daycare, to daycare or childcare for their citizens. And that's just another thing that there's no real reason why. And there's this idea that somehow people won't be taking care of themselves or being good citizens if they don't have a social safety net.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to David now in New Richmond. David, hi.
Hi. Say, I would 100% agree there's nothing wrong with the social safety net, but I would have to disagree kind of with the premise here. You know, my grandparents came from Germany and had nothing, and my grandfather apprenticed at the railroad and worked his butt off, became a shop manager, and my father apprenticed, became an expert in the rail industry. Working at railroads, which were union-based, but here's something that my grandmother said. When my father ended up going with another railroad that went bankrupt, and he went out on his own as a businessman, and I was complaining that he was gone a lot, and this is what my grandmother said to me. There are people who let things happen, and there are people who make things happen. Which one are you going to be? Whether it's a job that you're trying to get better at, or the business that he's trying to make, you have to make a decision in your life. What kind of person are you? Are you going to let things happen, or are you going to make things happen? That stuck with me the rest of my life.
David, thanks for the call. Alyssa, your thoughts?
Well, you know, it takes 10,000 hours to have mastery over a domain. It was one of the studies someone had done, and it's been proven over and over again that kind of hard work and effort and exertion is really how we become good at something. So the caller's right. It does take hard work, but it's not hard work alone. And that's just the point of this book, that it's gone into overdrive. I mean, yes, my grandparents were immigrants. They came from Poland, Hungary, Russia, and they didn't speak English when they arrived, and they became American citizens and, you know, sent me to college and money working in a shoe store. So I'm with the caller. I understand they work 6 hours, 6 days a week. But at the same time, right now it's this kind of rise and grind mindset. Like if you go on TikTok or social media, you'll see you can they say things like 9 to 5 is for the week, or you know, you have to have lots of side hustles. And it's a really frightening version of this hard work ideology that we live with, you know, that is not, it's not really supportable, because one of the things of the messaging is that you have to do lots of different things, which is not what your grandparents did or what my grandparents did, because that kind of dissipates your energy. But they're saying you got to, you know, work as a physical therapist and a personal trainer, and then you have to sell CBD, and then part of a multi-level marketing scheme. It's the variety and the the number of things that gigs that we're supposed to be working and the lack of, unionization for the work that we do have.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to journalist and author Alyssa Court about her latest book. It's called Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about self-reliance, how we talk about it, think about it, practice it here in the United States? Do you have ways in your family, your neighborhood, your group of friends where you depend on each other, rely on each other? Do you feel bad when you have to reach out for help, whether it's to a friend or family member or to a government program? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking to journalist and author Alyssa Court about her new book, Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Alyssa, before we go back to our callers, I want to talk sort of about the emotional side of our attitudes toward help. I'll share a very, story from my own household. I've been married a long time. When I'm sick, my wife takes care of me. When she's sick, I take care of her. Invariably, the sick one getting taken care of apologizes again and again. I'm sorry. I'm such a pain. I'm such a bother, blah, blah, blah. And the other one's like, shut up. That's what we're here for. Why do we feel so ashamed, maybe, or apologetic in those moments where we might need help, even though we know we're going to offer it the next time around?
That's so funny, because I think this is what the difference between the Midwest and like a strong elbow New or sharp elbow New Yorkers, because yeah, when I'm sick, I'm like, get me the orange juice. There's no apology. What I'm trying to develop in myself, and I want others to find in themselves, I call it the art of dependence, not just interdependence, dependence. And it's really hard to learn how to either take care of someone else or be taken care of without apologizing, and to see it as an art and a craft and a skill, like something that we should be proud of. Like, usually we're ashamed of any dependence that we have, and independence is what we value. When kids, climb on the monkey bars, we say, good, you're doing it by yourself. But, the parts of children that are dependent and the parts of adults that are dependent are of value too. And so that's part of what I'm trying to do in this book. It's also I call it radical self-help. It's like to have more acceptance for ourselves when we are at our most vulnerable and needy, so we can also accept others when they're vulnerable and needy.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Heather is with us in Brookfield. Heather, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Heather?
Yeah, this is a really interesting topic because it brings me to a specific time in my life when I had just had twins. And it was interesting. I was in another state, and there's state. My husband was a student and going through a master's program and working. And so we were on Medicaid, but under Medicaid, they did not even let me see an OB-GYN. They just had me see family medicine residents. The whole time I was pregnant with twins, and I didn't even see an actual OB-GYN until I had complications after the operation. And I remember standing in my apartment, and I had complications. I didn't understand them. I couldn't do the things that I used to be able to do. And my parents were there to help me, who came from a rugged line of pioneers. And my dad went to Harvard. They were hard workers and instilled that hardworking aspect in me, which I lived my whole life. But up until that point, I suddenly couldn't do the things I used to be able to do. And my dad said, Heather, you need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And I knew that I couldn't. Like, that was not possible.
Heather, thanks a lot for sharing that story. Alyssa, we can be self-reliant until sometimes we can't.
Yeah, I just found that very moving, Heather, because that was part of when I recognized dependence, or I both my daughter's dependence on me and my dependence on others. When I was pregnant, I was at hyperemesis the whole time. I don't know if anyone has had that, but you're sick the whole time. It's what Kate Middleton had. And you know, you become very dependent on people, something you're not used to when you're, you know, youngish. I was in my 30s, a woman. So the Medicaid story is heartbreaking that you didn't get adequate care. But I also think I'm glad that you had a voice inside yourself that said, I can't do this alone. I need more than this. And that's part of it. I mean, we can try to find the resources, try to develop them both politically, economically, and in our neighborhoods, you know, within doing it ourselves. But we also have to have that voice inside ourselves saying it's okay to need it. So thank you for sharing that.
Heather, thanks a lot for calling in, talking to Alyssa Court about her new book, Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. Alyssa, you conclude your book offering some advice. There's going to be a lot of policy debates about what state and federal government might do, but you also offer suggestions about how people can build communities where people help each other. Can you share some of the practical advice you give in the book?
Yeah, so I went on a journey, really. It was during the pandemic, and I went on a journey to find alternative American dreams. And I did find them. I found them in the ways that people were organizing businesses, something called worker co-ops, where the workers own their own labor. They own their companies or the nonprofits that they work for. And I interviewed many people who belong to those. I talked to people who were part of mutual aids. I'm sure in Madison and other parts of Wisconsin, you guys had that during the pandemic, where people delivered food to their ailing neighbors, and it was reciprocal. It's not a charity. You may give food one day or pharmaceuticals one day, and the next day you receive it. Other forms like participatory budgeting, where citizens help decide city budgets and they sit in on meetings. Again, it's a voluntary thing. And also kind of therapy that was interesting, because right now we have a epidemic of anxiety and depression. And this was kind of mutual care therapy that was peer-to-peer therapy, where people would talk about their economic struggles, sort of like what Heather just did, as part of the therapy. And I found that very beautiful. I came up with a name for it, inequality therapy. But these are just a few of the fixes that I found, new American dreams that I found.
Do you have thoughts for us to do kind of, I don't know, maybe a self-reliance gut check and inventory to see, hey, yeah, these are ways I can be totally self-reliant, and that's cool. These are ways where maybe I should let some help into my life.
Yeah, that's sort of what I've been trying to do when I've been talking to people about this. And I mean, one thing that I've done is to try to find the sources of my own strength or happiness or achievement. Think about who was behind them and sort of attribute. It's that's become my mantra. Rather than gratitude, I think about attribution. So, you know, the people I work with at the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, my mom, my grandparents, you know, my daughter. Yeah, just all the people like you, the people that I worked with in Wisconsin, you know, that really shaped me, changed my life, teachers I've had. And that's just, it's been nice to think about creative output or work output as a collective thing rather than just done by oneself. It makes it more meaningful, really.
Alyssa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Alyssa Court, journalist and executive director of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Bootstrapped, Liberating Ourselves from the American Dream. You could also hear the work she did with, to the best of our knowledge, on the three-part series Going for Broke. We've got a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. Plus, if you need information about changes in Badger Care Plus, we've got a couple links up there alongside that one. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, when you buy a product, a phone, a computer printer, a car, a coffee maker, piece of farm equipment, do you own it? Easy question, right? Of course you own it. You bought it. But our next guest says, wait, not so easy. If you crack the screen on the phone, can you repair it yourself or take it to any shop? Some manufacturers might stop certain features on your phone if you do. Same goes for expensive combines and tractors on farms. And more manufacturers are creating subscription fees to use features on your product. Some car companies, for example, have fees to use your seat warmer or enhanced acceleration features, again, on the car you bought. Printers get mad at you if you try to use third-party ink cartridges. Our next guest says we're seeing ownership rights chipped away, but we can do something about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you run into this? Have you tried to repair something or get something repaired, but found out that you could void a warranty or even end up with an unusable product? Have you bought something and then had to pay a regular fee to keep using some features on it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nathan Proctor is Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at USPIRG, the Public Interest Research Group. Nathan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Now, I've heard about the repair issues, and we'll talk about the right to repair concept in a bit. But this new piece you wrote, we've got it linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Something a little different here. How are companies finding ways to get people to keep paying to use features of products they already bought?
Yeah, it's something that is kind of at the heart of the Right to Repair campaign is this premise that you bought it, you own it, you should be able to use it however you want. But because the products that we use now are dependent on software and the internet, there's just all kinds of opportunities for the manufacturer to code them in such a way or to control them through the internet in such a way where they get to tell you what to do with the product. And a lot of times they're using that control to get you to buy more things from the company, more services, you know, upgrades. I mean, people know the printer ink, for example, you know, that if you want to get the printer ink that's made by the company, it's a lot more expensive than the alternatives. But the alternatives, it's very difficult to get them to work. And that's because of the software restrictions that are put inside the printer that just make it hard for the you know, aftermarket companies to supply compatible cartridges. And this is happening. It's going to happen more and more, especially with the internet, because that gives companies the ability to you know, change the terms of use remotely to try to continually, you know, hassle you to get you to buy more stuff from them. And that's wrong.
I shared one of the examples from the piece you wrote. I had not heard of this. A couple of car companies are saying, yeah, your car comes with a seat warmer. And if you subscribe and pay money, you can use the seat warmer and some other features. What is going on in cars?
Well, I mean, the companies that make these cars are being basically pushed to find ways to get more monthly revenue out of the car. And it doesn't matter if it's fair or reasonable in some of these examples. It's just technologically possible. It's actually technologically trivial, right? But it's extractive and wrong. Like that same example, I mean, the first time I heard of that, I was like, well, why wouldn't you just bypass the internet and put a switch there? I mean, the seat heater is physically in the car. It's not difficult to turn something on and off. You don't need an internet connection for that feature. It'd be like if the person who made you, a contractor who built your house, charged you monthly subscription fees so that the light switches worked. I mean, we wouldn't accept that because it's ridiculous, and we shouldn't accept it in our cars either.
There's just a few examples in your piece. If I'm reading it right, your concern is this is just the early wave, and we're going to see a lot more of this kind of thing potentially in consumer products.
Yeah, I was talking with you know, a friend of mine at a child's birthday party, and he said that, you know, in his line of work, there's just these Wall Street guys, he said, come in and they just try to push you to find whatever way you can to find some way to force people to pay monthly for things. And there's so much pressure because there's so much profit margin in that kind of business operation that they're just going to even if it doesn't make any sense, even if it drives customers crazy, there's just so much money to be made that unless we set up rules to say you're not allowed to do this, it's just going to happen more and more with more different products.
Talking to Nathan Proctor with US PERG. He heads the campaign for the right to repair there. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about these ways that companies try to get you to pay for stuff monthly that you already bought from them, and the right to repair and how difficult it can be to repair things yourself or to go to a repair shop, unless it's the manufacturer's repair shop. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Ryan is with us in Green Bay. Ryan, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
I just want to say, as somebody who's kind of been the family IT repair guy, who's been working on fixing cracked screens since Samsung Galaxy S1, that I find this whole right to repair thing absolutely critical to fighting the, you know, subscription-based model that we seem to be moving for absolutely everything. If we want to talk about vehicles, let's talk about John Deere and how they're affecting the farming equipment that's being used by farmers in our region. If we want to talk about consumer products, we can talk about Apple and their continued fight to not include USB-C standardization in the EU, even though it's been passed by law. I feel like if somebody like me, who knows how to repair things and has, you know, the will to learn how to do so, because I don't have a degree in IT or anything like that, but I can, you know, put a couple screws together and I can remove some glue, I should be able to do that for something that I already paid for, and I shouldn't be stuck behind some kind of firmware wall when it comes to some sort of software keeping me from using my device exactly how I want to. And if anybody wants to look up more of this right to repair stuff in a digestible way, please look up Lewis Rossman on YouTube. I've been following him for years now, and it's just a great resource in terms of trying to figure out what this thing is all about and how important it is to us as consumers in a capitalist society that says we should be able to own things. No, maybe not so much.
Ryan, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Nathan, Ryan, pretty fired up there. Clearly, a couple things he brought up. First of all, he's been replacing screens on his family's phones of various makes and models for years. You write that there was at least for a while an effort to say, yeah, if you start doing that, we're going to start cutting some of your functionality. What did we see there?
Yeah, so in when the iPhone 13 first came out, if you replace the screen, you know, the front-facing camera, which handles the Face ID, is connected to the screen. And if you had it repaired outside of Apple's control, basically without Apple software, it would deactivate Face ID. It would become inoperable. And so eventually Apple pushed out a firmware update that would made it possible for aftermarket, you know, shops to repair the screen. And now it just gives you a warning that, you know, ooh, this was done by somebody who was non-genuine or whatever. And I agree with the caller 100%. And you can just hear how frustrated and annoying it is to be told that you can't do something just because you're not blessed by the manufacturer. I think it's fundamentally un-American. Like, we're a nation of tinkerers and makers. Like, we're not just consumers, like, we're producers. So many of the innovations that make our lives great are things that, you know, people came up with tinkering in their garage, including these companies that are now telling us we're not smart enough to touch our own products. Like, they started in garages. And I think that they need to extend the same kind of collaborative, you know, cooperative hand to us that made their technology possible.
Ryan also brought up a key issue here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Very expensive farm equipment with proprietary software, unique tools that you might only be able to get at a manufacturer-approved shop. What are we seeing there, Nathan?
Well, first of all, I mean, I would say that for both, you know, these consumer products and farm equipment, we've now won state laws which mandate that the companies like Apple and John Deere have to share the materials that they use in their authorized repair shops with independent mechanics and technicians and product owners. But farm equipment is a huge, you know, leading issue on right to repair, in part because farmers are completely dependent on functional working equipment to make a living and to stay in business and to keep their farm. And when the only way to get something fixed because of a an intentional technological lock on the equipment that makes it so you have to use certain software tools to get it working again, and the dealer is the only one in possession of those tools, like that creates a huge problem for farmers. The biggest problem there is the downtime. If the equipment's not working and you need to get the seed in the ground or get the fertilizer down or harvest the crop before a big storm, you're not going to want to be told by the equipment dealer, oh, we can't come out today, or we can't come out till 3 weeks from now. One example from Oklahoma in a recent report that we put out out to pasture said that the dealer told me it was going to be 9 months before they could calibrate the hydraulic equipment on his equipment so that it would go back into service. 9 months, that's an entire season. That's ridiculous.
Thanks again for that call, Ryan. We're talking to Nathan Proctor from US PERG about a recent piece he wrote on the death of ownership and the ways companies get us to keep paying for things we already bought and make it hard to get our stuff repaired unless we go to the company that made it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like it's gotten more difficult to repair stuff? Electronics, appliances, tractors, you name it. Do you have a product where you have to use something proprietary made by that company, printer cartridges, coffee refills, you name it, just to use the product you bought? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Nathan Proctor, Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at US PERG, the Public Interest Research Group, looking at the way companies make it harder for us to get consumer products repaired and new technologies that make us keep paying to use features on things we already bought, from phones and farm equipment, coffee makers to cars. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Nathan, before we go back to our callers, you mentioned some states are passing laws, including just very recently, our neighbors in Minnesota. What did we see there?
Yeah, Minnesota passed the broadest right to repair law we've seen. It mandates that manufacturers of a lot of products, although unfortunately not including farm equipment, have to share all the parts, tools, and information that they make available for their own authorized networks to fix things to the product owner and to independent shops. So starting in July of next year, it's going to be a lot easier to fix products in Minnesota, everything from, dishwashers and cell phones to, enterprise computing equipment and HVAC and a whole set of other products. And I think it's going to save people a lot of money. And it's going to cut electronic waste. And it's a really, really big deal.
Let's go back to our callers now. Rob is with us in Markesan. Rob, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Rob?
Microsoft. Recently, they did a deal where they did an update. And basically, all of the Office application on my computer disappeared. And finally got a hold of them on it. And took 3 weeks before they finally gave me a copy of it back, which was a different copy than what I had. So my product key didn't work. I had to spend another week to get the right flavor. But yeah, they did it as part of an update and it just disappeared. And it took almost a month to prove that I paid for it and that they should give it back.
Rob, thanks a lot for that call. Nathan, whether it's a computer or anything else that uses software, that software update, that's a chance for companies to do stuff that consumers like Rob aren't going to be too happy about.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly, I mean, one of the things that happens pretty frequently is a loss of features with an update. And that can be really upsetting. and you wonder if some of these updates are really to improve the security or the device operation or to accomplish something else. And I think, I mean, from a cybersecurity perspective, it's really scary when companies put, kind of other anti-consumer updates in those update files, because we really want people to update everything to the most latest version to patch vulnerabilities that help protect the internet against cybercrime. But people are resistant to doing that because they've had these experiences where they've lost key functionality because an update had some other change in it. And I think that that's definitely something that companies need to pay a little bit more attention to.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rob. Bridget joins us now in Superior. Bridget, hi.
Hi. I had a situation with an air conditioner, and I called the thermal guy who put it in, and he came out and took some parts apart and left it undone. I asked him to come and put it back together. He didn't. And I kept calling about the part. Got to the point where he wouldn't return my calls. Went on, I called different companies. And by the time the next company came, left it exposed, mice had chewed it. So, yeah. So then it wasn't, then they wouldn't cover the warranty and he wouldn't return my calls.
Bridget, thanks for the call. Nathan, I don't know if this is exactly a right to repair issue, but the idea that if there's only one game in town, only the manufacturer can repair it. If that was the case in Bridget's, I don't think that probably was here. You'd have no recourse. The idea that, okay, there might be multiple places you can go to get something repaired gives us a better chance that we're going to find somebody who can do the job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say, your likelihood of getting a good experience with a service technician is really enhanced by competition, kind of weeding the market of people who treat customers like this story we just heard. Like, hopefully we can, the market will squeeze those people out. And so that companies that treat their customers well and charge them a fair rate are the only ones around.
Bridget, thanks for that call. We're talking to Nathan Proctor, Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at US PERG. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Racine. Aaron, hi.
Hi. I wanted to comment or at least ask for some commentary on the transition to software as a service or computing as a service overall in that we're actually losing access to our computing devices and the software on them in a push for greater revenue and, more pervasive and perpetual licensing of software. You used to be able to buy Microsoft Office one time and use it for a decade, and now Microsoft wants us to buy a perpetual license every year. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that as it relates to
it. Interesting, Aaron. Thanks for that. Interesting question. Nathan, what do you think? We used to buy a box of software, install it ourselves, and own it as long as we had that computer. Now it's a service, Aaron says.
Yeah, I mean, this is the blessing and the curse of the internet, right? Where software is not a static application anymore, right? Because, a Nintendo cartridge pretty much plays the same now as it did, back in 1986. But the other games that we're playing are all dependent on the internet. And that just completely changes what we're buying when we buy software. I think that this is a big question. And I think that there, as I argue in the piece that you're referencing, The Death of Ownership, at least there's truth in advertisement when Microsoft says what you're paying for is the continual monitoring and updating of this and you pay monthly. At least you know what you're getting. It's obviously different if they sell you something and you think you bought it outright, but really you just bought the first, entry and now you have to pay monthly to actually use it. So they're separate issues, but I look forward to a world where there's just a lot more transparency, clarity, and options for people to have more control over the technology in our lives. And one of the problems we have in an overly consolidated tech market is, if people would rather just pay once and have something static and lasted exactly the way they bought it, maybe they would. But with so few options in the tech market, there's just not an incentive to create those products because everybody's looking for, these monthly revenue streams. And so they're just going to push us into these systems, whether or not we actually want them.
Thanks for that call, Aaron. And Nathan, talking about transparency, somebody might think, okay, well, I won't buy a product that's going to have this hidden monthly charge to use all of its functions. Is it always that easy to tell when we're buying something that that's going to happen?
I mean, the reason why, like, we have this thing in the Uniform Commercial Code and state laws that it that protects consumers from unfair and deceptive practices is because you shouldn't have to walk around the Best Buy and think, which of these products is not being marketed to me deceptively to trick me into paying for some monthly thing that I don't know about. Like, we just should not have, you know, you shouldn't walk around the grocery store. Yeah, maybe some of these products that say they're potato chips are really like rat poison. You shouldn't have to worry about that. There should be just standard consumer protection that the products that are being sold are safe and usable. And I think that that's what I'm advocating for, right? If you're going to tether somebody to a secret software arrangement where you get to extract a monthly payment from them, you know, that needs to be exposed and there needs to be transparency there. And people are being, you know, kind of duped by these companies and they find themselves totally dependent on their system, which now all of a sudden is way more expensive than they thought at the outset. And I think that, you know, the system should protect consumers from that kind of deceptive product.
Nathan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
That's Nathan Proctor with the Campaign for the Right to Repair at USPIRG. The piece we've been talking about called The Death of Ownership, we've got it linked over at wpr.org/centraltime.